If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So for early modern people, sleep was very closely linked to death. And actually, if you look at some of the content of bedtime prayers, they look very much like miniature rites of passage. So it's the same formulation of words that you get when people are preparing themselves as they're about to die.
That was Sasha Handley on how people regarded sleep in the early modern period.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today we're going to be hearing from Sasha Handley, who's a historian based at the University of Manchester. She's been researching the history of something that we all do on a very regular basis, perhaps even after listening to this podcast, and that is sleeping. Sasha is going to be bringing her expertise on this subject to an event on Saturday the 25th of November at Manchester Museum entitled Sleep Lost and Found, which is part of the UK-wide Being Human Festival. Our world history editor, Matt Elton, caught up with Sasha recently and began by asking her to tell us a little bit more about her event in Manchester.
Well, my event's called Sleep Lost and Found, and it's taking place at the Manchester Museum. And essentially, it's a partnership with the Children's Sleep Charity. And they and I share an interest in thinking about how we can improve public education around sleep behaviour, and particularly around the sleep behaviour of children, because we are well aware that we are in the grip of a sleep crisis. This is the term that has recently been used by the World Health Organization. And something like 40% of kids in England and Wales are currently believed to be suffering from some kind of sleep problem. Now, for the most part, that is behavioural in origin. So we're running this event to open people's eyes, I guess, partly to the value of getting a good night's sleep for physical and mental and emotional health. And we're trying to do that creatively by thinking about sleep's history. So we're looking back to the early modern world, the so-called golden age of sleep, and trying to draw through a few lessons that we can apply to modern day practices to think about why it was early modern people seem to have slept much more effectively, much more restfully than we do now.
That's really interesting. What sort of problems do you mean when you talk about the present day?
So for the most part, we're just looking at persistent sleep deprivation. And what I mean by that is that kids, and actually most adults in modern industrialised societies in the West, are getting consistently less sleep every night than healthcare practitioners advise. So I went to Bury High School this week, actually, to speak to a bunch of 12 and 13 year olds. They're supposed to be getting about 9.5 hours every night. And I found one boy who was getting 5.5 hours because he was playing on his PlayStation 4 until 1 a.m., getting up in the morning after about after only five and a bit hours sleep and feeling dreadful. And we know that that persistent sleep loss is linked to all kinds of horrible developments. So it's linked to higher rates of obesity, because what you do, of course, when you're tired is find another source of energy. So you're much hungrier when you wake up tired in the morning. We also know that kids are not performing at their best at school because they are consistently underslept. And we think most of that sleep loss is due to not eating the right things as bedtime approaches, but also to overstimulation and the use of devices with blue lights being emitted from them, which of course stops the production of melatonin in the brain, and that's your sleepy hormone that will get you to sleep at the right time.
So I mean, how recent is this?
That's a much harder one to answer. The technology here is obviously important. So a lot of historians are wondering whether the onset of industrialization is a major kind of game changer for the way that we practice sleep as we start to shift to a much more sort of mechanized system of clock time and factory time. And of course, that coincides with the widespread use of artificial lighting technologies as well. So the shift from your sleeping habits being driven more by the seasonal patterns of light and darkness to a kind of mechanized artificial electric lighting system is one that we think plays a really important part in shifting the kind of physical environment. But I think also our habits of sociability at bedtime have really transformed in the digital age. So it's only really in the last sort of 10 to 20 years that we have these handheld devices that are now a kind of routine part of children and young people's social interactions. So I think that has had a lot to do with the acceleration of these kinds of problematic routines in more recent times.
You talked there about the early modern period being a golden age for sleep. Why was it such a particularly good period?
Well, I think there are two principal reasons, and they're both about motivations. They had very powerful motivations for looking after their sleep in this period. And that's because getting a good night's sleep between 8 and 10 hours per night on a regular basis sat right at the centre of a preventative culture of healthcare. So it's very different to the kind of responsive mode situation that we have now. Medical interventions were expensive and not particularly effective in the early modern period. So actually it's the household that is the central space in which people's sleep quality is managed on a daily basis. So they make sure that they look after their sleep because keeping that in good regulation, along with getting enough exercise in the day, enough fresh air, is how you keep your bodily fluids in harmony with each other and how you maintain good long-term physical and mental health. So it's part of that very distinctive preventative healthcare culture. But sleeping well and having good regular bedtimes is also a really important way of people demonstrating that they're a good Christian. So it's a powerful part of their motivations as faithful people that, you know, that's one of the really key reasons that they were really concerned when they weren't getting enough sleep, because they thought, not only is it bad for my health, but I'm also disrespecting the God that I believe in by not practicing regular bedtimes.
So even if their reasons were different from ours, they did definitely know about the value of sleep, both for health and, I guess, moral reasons by the sound of it.
Yes, absolutely. So the sort of moral ethical framework around sleep is very different to the one we have today. I mean, you know, you can find any number of examples of people celebrating the fact that they only need sort of 4 or 5 hours sleep per night. Margaret Thatcher was famously one of them. I think Donald Trump is another.
I mean, it's certainly interesting that across society, though, people seem to now prize the fact that they are someone who actually somehow has evolved beyond the point of needing sleep, which seems strange.
They do think that, but it's unfortunately just not true at all. There's a huge amount of evidence emerging now from neuroscience sleep laboratories that are mapping the devastating effects that prolonged sleep loss has on body and mind. So there are now really powerful links connecting long-term sleep loss to higher rates of cancer, to higher rates of diabetes, to particular forms of dementia, including Alzheimer's. So you can never actually catch up on the sleep that you lose each and every single night. And recent figures suggest that most adults in modern Western societies are only getting an average of 6 hours each night. And we're supposed to be getting it at an average of 8.
So are there any lessons that we can draw from the golden age of sleep to help us get better at doing it in the 21st century?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually a lot of the things that early modern people did to encourage a good night's sleep are still important today. So, for example, they engaged in really helpful pre-bedtime habits. So they read a lot. They took part in sort of calming activities like embroidery, sewing. Of course, they knelt down and prayed at the bedside. And if you think about the physical and emotional effects that that activity has upon your body, it's actually a really effective way of calming the body and brain down at that crucial moment in the evening. It's a way of putting the cares of the day to one side and thinking about higher, more important matters. So they did that, but they also made sure that they that their diets were well set up to encourage a natural and healthy night's sleep. So they prioritised foods that wouldn't irritate the stomach at nighttime, and they prioritised ingredients that were thought to have a cooling effect. So they ate an awful lot of lettuce, and households were also manufacturing sleep remedies that they could just have on the shelf and pull off whenever they were having a disturbed night's sleep. And most of those soporific remedies work on this cooling principle as well. The idea being that disturbed sleep was usually caused by an overheating of the stomach or of the brain. So they took careful notes of what they were eating and when they were eating it, and made sure that good, healthy sleep routines were part of a more kind of holistic healthcare practice.
Something that interests me about the idea that they were doing these things partly as calming methods is the fact that there were lots of fears associated with sleep in this period. What sort of fears were those?
Yeah, so I think all societies across time and culture note some kind of apprehension of danger at bedtime. But of course, the source of those dangers are what makes cultures distinct from one another. So for early modern people, sleep was very closely linked to death. And actually, if you look at some of the content of bedtime prayers, they look very much like miniature rites of passage. So it's the same formulation of words that you get when people are preparing themselves as they're about to die, because there are any number of examples in scripture, which was obviously very well known in those years, and in classical literature, where sleepers were taken in the night, were destroyed by enemies, or indeed their souls were corrupted by the devil. So bedside prayers are actually an attempt to beg for God's protection during the vulnerable hours of sleep, because of course that's the period of time in which we're not able to defend ourselves and to discern the approach of potential dangers. On a more practical level, of course, they were also very worried about bed bugs, which were pretty endemic. And we know that they went to great lengths to cleanse their wooden bedsteads, which were often very old and very cozy places for bedbugs to hide. They also used to bathe their faces and hands with things like rose water in order to make sure that the bedbugs didn't come near those exposed parts of the body that weren't covered by the bedclothes. And I've even found one episode of somebody hanging a piece of cow's dung at the end of their beds to try and attract the bedbugs away from the sleeper's body. So it probably didn't smell very nice.
So, I mean, they were concerned about bedbugs and they were also concerned about the devil specifically. Is that right?
They were, absolutely, yeah. Because it is in the night that the devil is at the peak of his power, when his servants are thought to be most active in the world. So if you think about all of the stories we have of, or reports, I should say, of early modern witchcraft, they're usually most active at nighttime, when, of course, the guard of faithful Christians is down somewhat. So that's when we find a lot of instances of the devil creeping up on people. You know, we also have nightmares that are often thought to be inspired by the devil. They can have bodily origins, but there are things that can be induced by the devil's approach as well. So people are concerned to make sure that their sleep posture is correct to try and avoid the onset of a nightmare. So they try and avoid, for the most part, sleeping on their backs, because they think that's the position in which nightmares are most likely to come on. And sleep posture actually is kind of an interesting topic in itself, because most sleepers were recommended to rest on a stack of pillows so that there was a gentle slope created between their heads and their stomachs to prevent the regurgitation of food during the night. But they were also advised to sleep first on the right side of the body, which was thought to be hotter than the left. So it heated and helped to speed the process of digestion in the first half of the night. And then when you went to bed for your second sleep, because of course this is a period in which people are taking two separate phases of sleep for the most part, rather than the one consolidated cycle that we have now, when they return to bed for their second sleep, they're advised to turn onto the left, cooler side of the body to release the vapours that have built up. And so they'll feel refreshed in the morning when they get out of bed.
What do people do during that break between the two sleeps?
Lots of different things. It depended on who you were, what kind of house you lived in. So lots of people are staying in the bed chamber to read. We know that servants are up finishing household tasks that they didn't complete during the day. I found clergymen brewing beer at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, married couples often using that interval of time to procreate, to grow their family. And we also have evidence of people simply praying by candlelight or by the light of the moon if they're sat near a window. So a big range of things.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/historyextra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
How were ideas about good and bad ways of sleeping transmitted? How do people find out about them?
Well, partly, of course, it's generational. and we have lots of household recipe books that are full of soporific sleep remedies that were passed down from family member to family member across many generations. But we also have evidence from people's letters and diaries, where they're talking about having conversations with family members and companions. And then, of course, there's a huge amount of cheap printed medical advice, which is available on this subject. So if people didn't already know the best way to go about getting a healthy night's sleep, they could simply pay a penny for a ballad or a few pence more for a cheap printed pamphlet, which would give you the basic set of advice principles that I've already mentioned.
We opened by talking about children in the 21st century. Were children in this period thought of as being particularly at risk?
Yeah, children are, I think, thought to be particularly vulnerable. And we find some evidence of practices which probably look both strange and slightly dangerous to us today. So we have some evidence, for example, from North Yorkshire, well into the 18th century, which suggests that parents are actually hanging iron carving knives over the cradles of their babies during the night as a symbolic but also a kind of tangible way of scaring off diabolical forces that might visit them when parent isn't watching over them. Slightly less frightening than that, though, are putting the child to bed with a piece of coral or some kind of amulet, like a wolf's tooth on a neck chain. So those kinds of materials, which were thought to have protective qualities in this period, were often placed close to or near the body of the child when they're in bed at night.
Is there anything from this period that you'd like that you think would help people re-understand sleep and, I suppose, their lives more generally today?
I think there are a couple of things. Apart from the sort of practical advice about, regulating your diet and making sure you have the right kind of cool environment in which to sleep, which are all sort of embedded within early modern sleep culture as they are today, I think we can take a leaf out of their book in just noticing the degree of control that ordinary people took over their own sleeping lives, if you like. So, you know, there's a propensity today to simply seek out the advice of a medical professional or a kind of drug-based therapy if sleep is going wrong. And actually, it's the advocation of behavioural change, which I think is, you know, at the root of the shifting sleep culture that we need in our own modern, incredibly busy lives. You know, there are so many pressures that are condensing our sleep into a smaller and smaller space. And I think we need to recognise how important it is for physical and mental health, and also how much power we ourselves should have over sort of guarding its boundaries, as people did in the early modern world.
This golden age of sleep you refer to, when did it come to an end, if that's the right way to look at it?
Yeah, that's a tough one to know. So my research has ended in the mid-18th century, and I certainly don't think it's over by then. I would suspect that we're looking at a mid-19th century story, as I mentioned before, you know, with the onset of industrial forms of working practices, and of course the huge involvement of child labour in that process of economic and social transformation. So I think that's where the roots of some of the acceleration occur. But I also think that, you know, our digital revolution has got a lot to answer for, you know, in terms of offering us the devices which are occupying our attention, but also that, you know, they've become addictive, haven't they? Particularly at night time, when you've got that free time to be chatting to somebody in a different time zone on the other side of the world. So, you know, a global digital world has opened up any number of possibilities of ways to spend your time that appear, at least on the face of it, to be more exciting than going to bed at 10 o'clock. But, you know, there's nothing that makes you feel better than a good night's sleep, is there? You think about springing out of bed in the morning after a good 8 hours. There's no other feeling as good as that.
Is there any way in which you'd like your research to help people understand the period we're covering here in a different way? So this kind of early modern period, how would you like people to understand it differently, I suppose?
I mean, we know a huge amount about the early modern periods, and it's pretty startling in a way that my book is the first sort of explicit attempt to write a history of its sleeping habits. So there's a lot more to be done, but I think it also opens a nice window onto the kind of daily preoccupations and anxieties of a typical household. So you can get to the kinds of people who don't appear, for example, in legal records, or who haven't left their own sort of individual trace because, you know, they weren't rich enough or important enough or male enough to have cropped up in other sources. So I think, you know, we need to do a lot more of that bottom-up kind of history to really piece together a fuller picture of the sleep culture of this period. But I hope at least that this research will spark lots of future inquiries and perhaps correct some of my assumptions by going into a lot more depth about the kind of contrast, for example, between those who live in the countryside and those who live in towns. There's a huge amount that remains to be done, but it's a step in the right direction.
Definitely. I mean, are there any particular mysteries that you'd like to see solved?
Well, I think your question about when does the golden age, if we should indeed be calling it that, when does that end and why does that end, is a really important one. So I think that is a crucial question that many people, and not just historians, need to start thinking more seriously about, absolutely. In terms of other mysteries, are there any other that I would like to be solved? I guess there's a lot more to be done on sleep disorders in this period, which do exist. So we have accounts of sleepwalking, which are quite interesting and really understudied. And we also have a few insomniacs as well, who I really haven't had time to study in depth yet. So it'd be really interesting to see if any of the genetic sleep problems that we have in the modern world were actually present in the early modern world as well. So whilst I've been saying that a lot of our problems today are by behavioural issues, that's not always the case. There's always an unlucky small percentage of people who are genetically predisposed to some kind of sleeping problem. So I'd love to know more about them, actually, in my period of history.
That was Sasha Handley. Sleep, Lost and Found takes place at Manchester Museum this Saturday, the 25th of November, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can find out more details at beinghumanfestival.org. And Sasha's book, entitled Sleep in Early Modern England, is out now, published by Yale University Press. Now, if you're interested in contributing to our understanding of sleep, our sister magazine, BBC Focus, is conducting a research project with Goldsmiths, University of London, looking at the sleep phenomena of exploding head syndrome and sleep paralysis. They're asking people to participate in an online survey on this topic, which is available at sciencefocus.com/bigsleepsurvey. Now, just before we go, here's a reminder that our York History Weekend is taking place over the next few days. Tickets to some talks will be available at the event, so please do come along if you can. OK, well, that's about it for today, but please do listen in on Monday when we'll be discussing the hellish world of Victorian hospitals.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.